This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
The J Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this week's episode, Sam Robson from Football Radar guests to review all of the games from J1 Match Day 15. And we'll also be joined by Adrian Serna on Takefusa Kubo's stunning move to Real Madrid, and by Stuart Woodward on Yokohama's ultimately disappointing trip to Shimizu. The J-Talk podcast starts now. J1 returned from the international break with a full round of games over the weekend, and Sam Robson has returned to the pod to round them all up. Sam, welcome back to J-Talk. How are you?
Very well, thank you, and thanks again for having me back.
Always a pleasure, Sam. It's great to get your thoughts once again on another action-packed match day in the top flight. And we'll start where we've seemingly been starting every week for the last couple of months. That's with the table toppers FC Tokyo, but they were not the main story on Saturday night at Ajinomoto Stadium, Sam, in front of an announced sellout, but obviously the bad weather during the day saw a couple of thousand fair weather fans stay away from the ground. But yes, they saw Andres Iniesta make a triumphant return, firstly to the Kobe team and also to the Kanto area. He scored a terrific goal that ultimately won it for Vissel 4 minutes after the break.
Yeah, it was actually good to see him actually on the pitch. He's been out with an injury for the last few weeks and maybe around a month. And as you mentioned, doesn't seem to fancy a visit to Kanto very often. So it was great for him to turn up. It definitely improved the way Kobe played, which is kind of a bit of a stupid thing to say. But he absolutely ran the game from his midfield position a little bit deeper than he's been used to, I suppose, for Kobe. He's in a position that Thorsten Fink likes to utilise. And he created a lot, controlled the game, and obviously won it with a fantastic goal.
Yeah, well, we were talking about Thorsten Fink last week with Tobias Dreimann, Sam. It looks like Kobe have hit the nail on the head. Now the most successful manager in J-League history with a 100% success rate. He should probably pack his bags, take his paycheck and ride off into the sunset.
Well, if his record at Austria Vienna or Grasshoppers suggests anything, he probably should quit while he's ahead. But it's a great start for him. I don't really know how much influence he managed to have on this, because he only got his work permit the day before the game. So I don't think he's trained the players in any session before, but he changed the system up, went back to a four at the back, had Iniesta as like kind of deep, but controlling all the play. And that seemed to really work. And it was one of the better performances from Kobe this season. And hopefully they can build on that, but I mean, there are still areas to work on, because they could easily have lost that game.
Yeah, well, there certainly were chances at both ends, Sam, and as an FC Tokyo supporter, I'm obviously frustrated with the result, and it came obviously without two of Tokyo's key players so far this season. As we all know now, Takefusa Kubo is not returning to the Gasmen after the Copa America. He signed for Real Madrid late last week, and it was a Kotaro Omori rather than Na Song Ho who was preferred to play in Kubo's former role from the start on Saturday night. And with Kensuke Nagai also out of the team, Sam, it was a young Kichi Yajima who started in the league for the first time, and he actually had three really good chances. Yajima, one, drew a brilliant save from Kim Seung-gyu in the first half, but there were a couple of misses that the Yajima would definitely wish that he had back. So how much of a difference did it make not having Kubo and Nagai in the team for Tokyo in the way that they went about things and in the way they operated on the evening?
I think it made quite a bit of difference. I think for Yajima, his movement was really good, and that's what you get from Nagai as well. But the finishing, although we kind of criticise Nagai as well for his finishing, he's been a lot more prolific this season. And just last week against El Salvador, he was on fire. He couldn't miss. So that sort of finishing was missing. Yajima maybe snatched at his chances a little bit. His best one was the one that was really well saved. But otherwise, when he had a bit more time to think, he kind of maybe made the wrong decision or didn't quite find the finish. And Kotaro Omori is just a bit of an average player. He does his job okay, but I don't think he adds any sort of creative spark, or he's not going to really worry any defender. So that's what you lose on the right hand side with Kubo not there. So it was a massive miss for both of them. And I mean, this doesn't necessarily bring panic bells to Tokyo, but there's definitely areas for concern. And I think it highlighted a lot more that they really do need to go into the transfer window and get especially a right-sided player to replace Kubo, because at the moment with Omori, it's not really going to work out. I think Narsongho would have been the better option, but maybe he'd just come back from international duty with Korea. Maybe there was a hint of tiredness there that meant he started on the bench, but he'd be the one I'd go with for the time being, but I'd definitely look to try and get someone in to replace Kubo.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, Sam, that I'm not pushing any panic buttons, but I'm wondering whether my finger should be maybe hovering over the button, because, we don't know for sure how long the guy will be out. But, I mean, it sounds silly to me to be talking about him as such a key player, because, you know, at the start of the season, and I referenced this before about Kubo, if you said to me that Kubo and the guy not being around would have a massive impact on whether Tokyo had a chance of winning the league or not, well then, yeah, I just wouldn't have thought that was possible, because they basically were fringe players at the start of this season, in my eyes. Obviously, Kubo was going to get a chance under Hasegawa, and the club wanted to get basically as much out of him as they could before he turned 18, and hoped that his involvement in the first team would, you know, encourage him to stick around at least for the rest of this season. But as we say, we now know that is not happening. And it does look a different team. There were positive signs from Yajima, and as I think we both said in a roundabout way, yeah, I think Narsongho would have been a better choice than Omori, and perhaps he will be preferred going forward. But yes, I just hope that Takashi Usami's got his phone switched on, and that Kenta Hasegawa, goes cap in hand to the front office and says, you know, I know this player, I know what he could bring to the team, and I think we should try and push the boat out to bring him in. I've banged that drum for the last few weeks now, but I think he would come as close as you can to filling the void with a proven Japanese player that wouldn't need time to settle into the J-League or indeed settle back into the J-League.
Yeah, that's definitely the sort of player you're going to be after, because at the moment, when you take Kubo out of that team, even with Nagai there, there's not a great deal of creativity. You've got Higashi on the one side who's done okay, but I don't think he adds the same spark that Kubo does. He's not going to get the same number of assists that Kubo would. So, and they're missing that. And then you've got Diego Oliveira, who is a really good player at keeping the ball, bringing players into play, and then kind of bullying defenders. But he goes through these streaks of either he's hot and he scores a lot of goals, or at the moment he's in one of his trenches where he's not getting anywhere. He's missed a hatful of chances against Kobe, mainly in the air. And it's just, without him scoring goals, at the moment Tokyo don't seem to have another option about where these goals are coming from now that Kubo's left. So, yeah, Usami would be a perfect, as perfect as you can get, I suppose, on that right-hand side, but Tokyo are going to have to battle with Gamba Osaka, who are looking to get the band back together with him and Idaguchi, rumoured to be returning. So it'd be interesting to see what happens with Usami in the summer.
Yeah, most definitely. So you mentioned Diego Oliveira there. I mean, he will have just been absolutely fuming with Yajima. I mentioned he had, you know, two or three of Tokyo's best chances. I mean, 5 minutes after Kobe took the lead, Sam, Kim Sung-gyu just passed the ball straight out to Yajima. Yajima was running through on goal with Oliveira to his right. All he had to do, as the keeper committed, thinking that Yajima was going to shoot, which he did, all he had to do was just slide the ball forward to Oliveira, and he would have been able to roll the ball into an empty net. But as you know, I suppose Yajim is a striker, and his role is to score goals. And if it was Oliveira in the same situation, I'm sure he probably would have tried to have a shot as well. But I mean, it looked like a gilt-edged opportunity for Tokyo to equalise. But it wasn't to be. And sorry, Kobe supporters, I know we did start talking about you, and the focus has suddenly switched in a massive way to Tokyo. But before we switch back to Vissel, Sam, can I ask you if you knew who Shuto Abe was before Saturday night?
Very little. I don't cover the J3 league, so my colleague does. So I knew a little bit about him. He played one game, I think. I think he's one of these specially designated players who's kind of at university but playing out a final year of university with sporadic appearances at a club, and this one is Toka. But he looked really like on fire as soon as he came on. A lot of energy. Looked like he had good technique and really kind of increased the tempo of the Tokyo play. And I'm looking forward to seeing a bit more of him.
Yeah, he looked like he'd been to the Nasong Ho School of Substitute Appearances, Sam. Yeah, Shuto Abe, a 21-year-old Meiji University student who, as Sam says, is a specially designated player. Had made just the one appearance for the FC Tokyo under-23 side in J3. And then Kenta Hasegawa throws him on with 10 minutes or so to go on for his J1 debut. And he did put himself about. For a J1 debut, having played, you know, one game in J3 before that, I mean, he acquitted himself reasonably well. But again, I mean, that's where Tokyo's at, Sam. They'd already brought on Na, and they'd already brought on Yuin Su, so the cupboard was pretty much bare. And yes, so Shuto Abe it was who was chosen as the Tokyo's third sub. And, well, I guess, yeah, he'll be one to watch going forward. A little bit of a pocket rocket in the style of Shoya Nakajima and Kubo, so we'll keep our eyes out for him in the coming weeks. It seems like, yeah, until Tokyo does some business in the transfer market, he might be involved from here on out in the match day squad. So, yeah, let's bring it back to Kobe for a couple of minutes before we move on, Sam. So, yeah, it was Thorsten Fink's first game in charge. As you said, he'd got his work permit pretty much the day before, so he was, straight on a bus to Ajinomoto Stadium, and he managed the team. So yeah, he went back to four at the back, Sam. We were expecting maybe three that had taken place in the previous game, but yeah, he set them out a little bit differently and made themselves pretty hard to break down. So after they had taken the lead, even that good chance from Yajima aside, and I mean, you know, Kento Hashimoto's header hitting the post in the last 10 minutes. They were fairly resolute, weren't they?
Yeah, fairly, especially in open play. At least they were kind of well marshaled. They cut their two banks of four by the time that they were 1-0 up. They were still a bit susceptible from crosses. I thought the pairing of Osaki and Mia really struggled with Diego Oliveira in the air, so that's maybe a position where Dankler will come back in after his suspension and kind of shore that up. I mean, he's been susceptible to mistakes, but usually that's on the ground. In the air, he's been pretty dominant. I think that will definitely help Kobe going forward, but I thought he got his formation right. I think it's the formation that he's been using a lot, pretty much everywhere he's been. He's got this 4-3-3 really, and he plays that one midfielder who sits kind of on the diamond, a little bit like Pirlo would do for Italy and Juventus. Iniesta would be that guy. He'd sit there, he'd control the possession, he'd control everything. It would all run through him, and I think that's a perfect place to put a more ageing Iniesta. I think he'll be very dangerous from that position with Mita and Yamaguchi either side of him. I don't think Samper should get anywhere near this team again. I don't think he's up to the level, really. I mean, I know he's come from Barcelona, but I think I've been really disappointed with his performances. So I think this is the way that they could go. And they were definitely controlling possession, as they have done under previous managers, but this time it was with a lot more energy going forward. They'd get the ball forward quicker. Wellington, who I've been a bit iffy about, played very well. He was helping out defensively, but he'd get involved in the build-up. He's quite good with his feet, and him and David Villa kind of worked well together. So I think there are a lot of positives for Kobe, especially in possession and then generally defensively. But there are still going to be a few errors that creep in, including like the goalkeeper one that we've mentioned earlier. So it's not necessarily perfect for Kobe, but give Thorsten Fink a little bit more time, then hopefully he can build on this.
Yeah, most heavily. So, I mean, well, they're now three unbeaten, Sam, and they've won two and drawn one in their last three. So they've, I wouldn't say they've pulled themselves out of danger, but they did move two spots up in the table to 11th. I mean, there is a logjam of teams down there, basically from Kobe down. Kobe and Shonan both have 17 points down to bottom club now, Tosu, who have 13. So there's a lot of traffic down there, and yeah, it'll take a few more good results for Kobe to pull themselves away from that ruck of teams and start to feel a bit better about themselves. But yeah, it's a good start under Fink, and although yeah, Tokyo did have a number of chances, at the end of the day, if you don't mark Andres Iniesta and give him time to pick his spot, then he is certainly going to do it. I mean, Hayashi, we haven't really talked about the goal, have we? I mean, Hayashi showed a little bit too much of his near post, probably expecting Iniesta to cross from the edge of the box on the left. But yes, he, as I say, he found his spot inside Hayashi's near post. And yeah, absolutely inch perfect shot that ultimately the keeper was left flapping at. So it was a terrific goal from Iniesta and a good win for Kobe. And yeah, two losses in the last three games for leaders FC Tokyo. But similarly to when they lost for the first time this year, Sam, which was obviously only two games ago in match day 13, most of the teams around them weren't able to capitalise. In match day 13, of course, Tokyo lost also 1-0 at Cerezo Osaka, but the teams in second and third, Nagoya and Oita back then, also lost in that round. Well, this time around, Kashima Antlers were the only team in the top six to win in match day 15. Kawasaki, Nagoya and Oita all drew. Nagoya and Oita against each other, of course. And as I teased in the intro, and we'll come on to shortly with Stuart, Yokohama lost at the death away at Shimizu. So the damage was somewhat limited for Tokyo. And let's move on before we get Adrian's thoughts on Takefusa Kubo's move to Real Madrid. Let's talk about the three games that took place last Friday night, Sam, obviously involving some of the ACL clubs. Kawasaki were at home against Sapporo. That ended 1-1. The visitors at Consadole took the lead 6 minutes before halftime, thanks to a Musashi Suzuki penalty. But about 20 minutes from time, Yu Kobayashi equalised. But that was more to do with a howler from the Sapporo keeper, Gu Sung Yun, than it was for really much to say about Kobayashi's volley from just inside the penalty spot. Really should have been saved, and egg on his face for Gu. So I know you watched this one live on Friday night, Sam, and obviously at the end of the match day, Kawasaki will be kicking themselves that they've dropped points at home again.
Yeah, it's another example of Kawasaki really dominating games, having a lot of chances, but not putting teams to bed. In this game, Kobayashi, especially in the second half, missed a large number of chances. Gu, I know it's a horrible mistake for the goal, but before that, he was making save after save after save to keep Sapporo in that game. So I felt very sorry for him that the one error he made allowed Kobayashi to score, because without that, Kobayashi had no chance of scoring. His radar was completely off all game. And they'd already missed a penalty in the first half through Leandro Damião. Don't know about the decision. I think it's pretty soft. The referee, Mr. Yamamoto, the same referee that did the Shonan Urawa game with that horrible mistake, he didn't want to keep himself out of the headlines. Two penalties in the first half, but another couple of calls that could have gone for one team or the other. So he just, yeah, loved the attention, I suppose. But yeah, Kawasaki will be so disappointed, especially as after the way they drew with Urawa and then before the international break. This is another one, another 2 points dropped and another chance to gain on Tokyo that they've really let slip through their fingers.
Yeah, so as I say, with Tokyo top, I'm certainly not taking anything for granted. I mean, and after the match day, Tokyo's lead was cut by a point to 5 points, which obviously is means nothing with 15 games of 34 played. So much water to go under, so many bridges that, as I say, we're, as Tokyo supporters, I think we're enjoying it while it lasts. And, yeah, Kawasaki have wasted opportunities in the last few weeks to really put pressure on that buffer. But, yes, I'm sure they'll be coming throughout the summer. So, yes, Frontale supporters well aware of what their club is capable of and obviously what they've done in the league, winning it in two straight seasons. All right, well, yeah, I mentioned Kashima were the only top six team to win in match day 15. They also played on Friday night, rather. They hosted Cerezo Osaka and won 2-0. And also on Friday, Hiroshima hosted Shonan and won by the same scoreline. Both victors left it a little bit late into the second half before they got on the score sheet. At the Kashima Soccer Stadium, Serginho scored 5 minutes after the break from the spot after Leandro was fouled by Yusuke Marohashi. A bit of a leaping salmon job by Leandro after Marohashi stuck his leg out to, well, not to try and trip him, but certainly that's what ended up happening. Serginho squeezed his penalty just past the dive of Kim Jin-hyun. And then after Ryohei Shirasaki cut out an underarm throw by Kim as the Cerezo keeper attempted to build from the back in the 72nd minute, Shirasaki fired in a 25-yard rasper after being teed up by Shoma Doi. So Sam, Kashima moved to within a point of Kawasaki. They moved above Yokohama on goal difference. And, things are shaping up fairly well for Kashima. As we've said throughout the season, they haven't really hit too many heights. But lo and behold, here they are, 6 points off top. And, just as fearful a prospect for Tokyo as Kawasaki, I'd say.
Yeah, they just did what Kashima do. It was a very professional performance. I thought first half was pretty even. In fact, Cerezo started the better team, so they just couldn't take advantage of their early pressure. And then once Kashima got the early penalty in the second half, once that went in, they were in complete control of the game. I think it shows the quality in the team that they can rest Leo Silva ahead of the Champions League and still have a terrific midfield. Shintaro Nago came in alongside Kento Misawa, and he played really well. They controlled the second half pretty easily. Weren't too many chances for Cerezo. And they're looking like they're going to go on another run like they did last season. They were further back last season and then managed to get into the Champions League places while winning the Champions League themselves. So I think they might be the team to worry about if I was a Tokyo supporter. They got a lot of options. They've got very good players, and I think they just look like they're coming into a bit of form.
Most heavily. So what of Hiroshima then? They left it into the second half before they got going. And again, they, as with Kashima, their first goal came from the penalty spot after Rikosuke Takatomi fouled Tsukasa Morishima, Douglas Vieira scoring in the 67th minute. And then Sho Inagaki finally put it to bed 2 minutes from time, and Morishima was involved again. Morishima dribbled into the box on the left and, cut back for Inagaki to fire home side-footed. So, a decent performance from Sanfrecce. And, they've steadied their ship with now three unbeaten after that pretty sizable wobble they had after their first defeat.
Yeah, they seem to have got it back up on the straight and narrow. They brought in Morishima, as you said, and he's been really good in behind the striker. He came into the team maybe a couple of years ago and looked really good, but then has dropped off for a long period. But he's come back. He's full of energy. Good link-up player with Douglas Vieira, who's come back from injury as well. And it's looking like they're kind of building a bit of a stronger attacking unit. This game, I saw the stats before that I watched it, and it was like 25 shots to Sanfrecce. So I thought, what has gone on here? That's not the Sanfrecce I know. But it was a lot of long-range shots. They didn't really create too many good chances. They got the penalty. It was quite random in the way it happened. The ball flicked up in the air, and Takatomi doesn't know that Morishima's behind him and brings him down. And then for the second goal, Douglas Vieira stood on the goalkeeper. He's not offside, but he's definitely obstructing Akimoto's route to the ball. So I think there's an argument that could have been disallowed as well. But defensively, they were solid as they usually are. Didn't concede too many chances to Shonan, too many good chances at least, and I think they deserve their victory, and it's good to see them back in form as well, and they've got a big Champions League game against Kashima on Tuesday, so that's going to be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, as you say, yeah, Kashima hosting the first leg of the ACL round of 16 against the San Frecce with the return leg the following Tuesday down in Hiroshima. And if I forget to mention this later when we talk about Urawa's win over Tosu, they host Ulsan of South Korea on Wednesday night. That's also in the ACL round of 16. All right, then. So we have moved away from FC Tokyo, but now we're going to clip in a conversation I had with Adrian Serna, of course our regular Nagoya correspondent, but a man very much attuned to Spanish football, to get his thoughts on Takefusa Kubo's move to Real Madrid. Before we get to that, Sam, and remember this is a family-friendly podcast, can you sum up in a sentence or so your reaction to the news that Kubo was on his way to Madrid?
I'd say surprised and a bit excited for him. I think you can't turn down a move to Real Madrid. I think, I mean, it's a shame that he's not going to be playing regular first-team football for the first season, but he's going to go with the reserves. He's going to train with the players as well. Like, he can learn off Hazard, who's just signed, and those sorts of players. He's got Raul as his manager. I think it's going to be a really exciting move for him. It can go one of two ways. I know the pessimist will say he might turn into Odegaard. The more optimist would say maybe Vinicius Junior. So I'd like to see where it goes. I think he'll get chances in the Copa del Rey, and he'll play a few games like UEFA Youth League as well. So I think it'll be a good move for him. It's going to be a daunting task to go to Real Madrid, especially as a Barcelona graduate, but I think it's exciting for him, and I can't wait to see how he develops.
All right, then. So without any further ado, here's my chat with Adrian. Well, hands up if you saw that coming. Just 10 days after turning 18, and with his now former club FC Tokyo blindsided by the announcement while he was away at the Copa America with the Japan squad, Takefusa Kubo was announced as a Real Madrid player last Friday. To talk about the stunning news and what it actually means for Kubo's career in the next few years, I'm joined by Adrian Serna. Adrian, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm excellent, thanks. Now, regular listeners will know, Adrian, you are our Nagoya Grampus correspondent. And
that's it, yeah.
And those who also follow you on Twitter are almost certainly aware that Barcelona are your team in La Liga. So how have you taken the news that Japan's brightest footballing prospect, an ex-Barca youth player, of course, has it chosen your bitter rivals?
Well, first of all, I think it's a huge surprise. Nobody did expect that Kubo will have chosen Real Madrid above Barcelona or maybe other teams in Europe, but especially Real Madrid, since he's a Barcelona youth system player. So that was a huge surprise.
Do you think the average Barca fan even knew who he was, though? I mean, he was obviously he was banging them in for the under-11s and the under-12s. But, I mean, that was, you know, now 6 or 7 years ago. Do you think an average Barca supporter will be disappointed that that they've missed out on him? Obviously, you're well aware of him because you live in Japan. But
I think that most of FC Barcelona fans, like, you read, like, Twitter comments or, like, you know, the press, or you listen to the Spanish press, the Barcelona journalists, they're not blaming Kubo. They're not saying, you know, he's a traitor, he left, you know, Barcelona gave him everything, like with other players. I think Kubo has a good, I think he's lucky that right now there's a big movement against the FC Barcelona current president, and most of the people are blaming him about for this as well. So they're blaming him on how the team is doing bad in Champions League, and blaming him on how the team, everything's going on in the last few years. You know, FC Barcelona has Messi, has the best player ever in the history of football, but they cannot win the Champions League. Real Madrid wins 3 Champions League straight. So I think that in different circumstances, where if Barcelona was in some kind of social peace, people will probably have the Barca fan will have gotten angry at Kubo, but if you read the comments, you listen to the Spanish Barcelona journalists, they blame this only exclusively on the FC Barcelona president, saying that he's an incompetent and that Real Madrid has stole Barcelona's Asian diamond. So I think Kubo is lucky in terms of timing.
I see. So obviously, yeah, most of us expected that when Kubo turned 18 that he would return to the Barca system. But I mean, we now know, and we're going to come on to talk about this in more detail, what it actually means. But Kubo is going to start next season and most likely play the entire season with Real's B team. If he had have returned to Barcelona at the same time, obviously he had done this coming preseason and been part of the Barcelona system again, do you think he would have been in the same boat? Would he have been playing with the Barca B team, or would he have even been loaned out to a team in a different country?
Yeah, I think that's the problem. I think that of course we all talk about rumors. We don't know the real truth about the negotiations. But some Spanish journalists, yeah, they report that they couldn't get an agreement in terms of, you know, Kubo was gonna be able to play for like Barcelona B team in not even like in the bench, but or like a starter. But you know, there were some rumors that Barcelona wanted to loan him to another team in Catalonia or in the third division, or because they could not offer him a position in the B team. So I think that was probably a big part of why Kubo selected Real Madrid. I think Real Madrid offered him what he wants, which is at least 1 year playing in the Jau system, so he can show that he's ready to play for a big club, and then maybe a move to someplace different.
All right then. So yeah, as I said at the start, the news broke on Friday, and obviously featured prominently on Japanese TV news bulletins. But I mean, it came on the same day that Shohei Ohtani became the first Japanese player to hit for the cycle in Major League Baseball. So it didn't always lead the sports news, which tells you a bit about how prominent baseball is covered in the Japanese sports media. But I mean, what about, we've spoken about it from a Barcelona supporter's perspective, Adrian. I imagine you don't spend too much time worrying about Real Madrid and their supporters, but how excited do you think they will have been by this announcement? I mean, will they be excited to have, you know, gotten one over Barcelona? Mm-hmm. But I mean, Luka Jovic and Eden Hazard have arrived in the last 10 days, so obviously Kubo is nowhere near the fish that those two are.
Exactly. The thing is, Real Madrid FC Barcelona is a team of Yale system. So the fans of FC Barcelona are always more taking care of what kind of players are playing for the B team, or they get more excited. Real Madrid players, they know that there's only few possibilities that the players in their B system, in the Yale system, end up in the first team. So I think Real Madrid fans are not so excited about Kubo. Of course, they're happy that they stole FC Barcelona's diamond, but they're not very excited in terms of maybe seeing him in the future in Real Madrid. Of course, they will be happy like with Vinicius last season. But only few players from Madrid youth system make it to the first team. So we still have to see if Kubo is able to be in that really short list.
Okay, then. So, yes, Real Madrid Castilla or Real B or whichever you prefer. I'm sure you have other names for them, Adrian. We can't use on a family-friendly podcast.
Yeah.
But
Castilla, they call them the Castilla in Spain.
Sure. So, I mean, I've read that Kubo will be training with the first team, but, playing in the Spanish third tier, managed by Raul, of course, one of the legends.
Yeah, I don't think Kubo will train with the first team, actually. Maybe he'll go to some international events now, like international friendlies, or maybe there could be some chances that sometimes he trains with the first team, but I think that mainly he's going to be playing with Castilla, as you mentioned, in the Spanish Segunda División B, which is the third tier division in Spain. And I also, but as you mentioned, with Raul as a coach, I think it's actually a good opportunity for him. I think it's a very good opportunity. Raul is a coach that he was also Joao's ace in Real Madrid. He came also from the rival. Raul came from Atletico de Madrid's Joao system. So I think that actually for Kubo is a great opportunity to have Raul as a coach. Being 18 years old, I think Raul can teach him lots about European football and the philosophy of Real Madrid. We cannot forget that Kubo was raised by FC Barcelona's play style and FC Barcelona's philosophy. So this is a different way of seeing football that they play in Real Madrid. So I think it's important that he focuses on playing in Castilla, on training with the rest of the guys. He's 18. Most of the players in Castilla are from 19 to 22 years old. So he's going to be probably the youngest one playing there. And of course, we'll have to see if he's able to start in the 11. So we need to be careful in terms of I don't think that he's going to be spending much time with the first team. But there could be some changes. Some chances. For example, in the Spanish Cup, or in the case Real Madrid has already qualified for the next round of the Champions League, you know, those games where you use the kids, or you use players that usually don't play a lot. Maybe in those games, Kubo has a real opportunity of playing with the first team, but he will probably focus on playing with Castilla, especially this first season in Europe.
All right, that's really fascinating, and it's a really interesting point that you make there. Obviously, yeah, to have once he's up and running at Real, to have experienced those two systems by a couple of months after he's turned 18. I mean, to have come through the youth a couple of youth levels at Barcelona, and now to be managed by Raul. And as you say, nobody better qualified to indoctrinate him into all things Real. It's going to be fascinating. What can he expect though on a week to week basis in terms of the Spanish third division, Adrian? I mean, the level. I mean, I'm not expecting you to compare it to J1, for example. But I mean, in terms of the quality of the opposition, yeah. And I don't know, perhaps well, you're slightly more physical than. What can you expect?
You're lucky because, you know, I watch a lot of Spanish Segunda División B because my hometown team plays in that third division. So I've been watching this Segunda B all my life. And I can tell you it's a very hard league. It's a very tough league. It's very technical. I think it's more technical than other leagues in Europe because there's one main difference between this Spanish third tier division and other countries in Europe is that, for example, in England, the big teams in the Premier League, they have their reserve team, right? And you have like a different separate reserve league. While in Spain, all the youth teams like Real Madrid B, like Atletico de Madrid, or Barcelona, Sevilla, all these strong teams, they have their teams play in the second or in the third division with the rest of the teams. So I think in terms of competition, it's more different. Complete, because you have the kids playing for Real Madrid. They don't play with other reserves. They play against 30 years old or 35 years old that have been playing all their lives in this third division. So I would say, again, it's of course more physical than team in a first division or in a second division where you have more technical players. But I think it's good that he also gets that playing in this third division, you get to know the more dirty football, the more football about tackles and maybe not so beautiful stadiums, more different than the beautiful stadiums in the first division. So in that terms, I think that you can expect Kubo that's going to be really good for him in terms of getting some experience that he didn't have in Japan, because he played some under 23 with Tokyo, but then he was playing with the first team really soon. So I think he needs to get to know the dark side of football. So one season in Real Madrid Castilla, I think, is going to be really good for him. He's going to play, and the thing is that the third division, you have really bad teams, but then you also have really good teams, really teams that could play perfectly in the Spanish second division. The Spanish second division is a really, really strong league. I would say it's after the French league, considering it like the four or five leagues in Europe, I would say then the Spanish second division in terms of technique is really, really advanced. So for him, I think he's going to stay 1 year in Real Madrid playing for Castilla, and then this is the usual pattern that Real Madrid does with these players. They play 1 year, and if they see that he has potential to go for the first team, they will tell him to stay another year in Castilla, and maybe like Vinicius this year, you know, some weekends you're going to go with the first team, you're going to train with them, even you'll have some chance to play. If not, Real Madrid will probably loan him to another team in the second division or even in the first division. That's how usually Real Madrid move their young players. So I think for Kubo, it was a good decision to come to Real Madrid, because he's going to be able to play now in a football that it's not so technical, but it's going to be a good experience for him, and he has the chance of in 1-2 years get to the first team, or maybe get to in a loan to another club.
All right. Well, yeah, it's such a fascinating move. I mean, sorry, Adrian, but let me just go back. You said your hometown club plays in the third division. What's the name of that club? I don't think I know.
Real Murcia.
Okay, right. Okay. Well,
yeah, but the third division is separated in four groups. So and each group changes every season. So we still don't know which teams Real Madrid will face this year. It will depend on how the different relegations and promotions. So they separate the third division into 40 different groups. So you play a league the whole year, and then the four top teams, they qualify to a playoff system in order to get to the second division. Actually, Real Madrid played this year the playoff in order to get to the Segunda División, the Spanish second division, but they lost against Cartagena, which is the biggest rival of my hometown. It's a city 50 kilometers from my hometown, and they lost Real Madrid Castilla in a really bad way. I think that was a really bad loss for them. I think they had the team to go to Segunda División. So again, it's very competitive. Real Madrid Castilla, they are in the third division, but they certainly aim to get to the second division, to the Spanish second division. So they have a lot of pressure to go up. So it's not going to be just 1 year of playing and relax. It's going to be a one tough year for the team, and also for Kubo, he has a responsibility.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, I imagine that DAZN are trying to negotiate the rights to the Spanish third division as we speak, so hopefully we'll get to see so, Kubo and yeah.
Actually, right now, the Spanish third division is a separate entity from the Spanish La Liga. So La Liga manages the first and the second division. Maybe it's like the Premier League in the UK. So, or like talking Japan. So J League and JFL. So you have J League that they manage J1, J2, J3. In Spain, it's the same. La Liga manages the first and the second division. The Spanish Federation, the Spanish FA, they manage this third division, and already right now they have an agreement where you can watch all the games in stream. So I'm not 100% sure if next season is going to be the same, but I think so, because actually I can watch my hometown's team football games here in streaming in a platform called, I think it's called Footers. Not like the bar we all know. So it's like Footers. That's if maybe you can look after. And that platform, they show on stream everywhere in the world the Spanish third division. So maybe I'm pretty sure we'll have the opportunity. And also Real Madrid Televisión, they show the games of their B team always. So I'm not 100% if that channel is available in Japan, but I think I'm pretty sure they offer that channel internationally in many countries. So I'm pretty sure they will work on offering the Kubo's games here in Japan. Not sure who, but I'm pretty sure we will be able to watch Real Madrid Castilla games here.
All right, brilliant stuff. So, yes, it's a beautiful coincidence that Kubo's made his professional debut for a feeder club, the FC Tokyo Under-23s, and it will now move to another. It's obviously going to be a massive step for him to eventually make it at Real Madrid and play regularly for the first team. But at just 18 years old, yes, the future is very much now for Takefusa Kubo. And as Adrian's mentioned earlier, we'll probably see him play some part in Real's preseason tours of the US and indeed Germany. They're going to go to the Audi Cup as well before, as we say, settling into life in the Spanish third division. And it's a terrific on the podcast to be able to lean on J-League correspondents for information about their home country. So last week it was Tobias Dreimann on Thorsten Fink, and this week Adrian on Takefusa Kubo joining Real Madrid Castilla. Adrian, thank you so much for your time. It's terrific to get your thoughts on this fascinating move, and I hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you. No problem. Anytime. I will be following Kubo as well. So anytime you want to talk about how he's doing, you know, I like to listen to the Spanish press. So I will get you the first the information before anyone.
All right. I like the sound of that. All right, Maya. Thanks again to Adrian Serna. Let's throw it back to Sam. And it might just be Stuart Woodward time too. Okay, my thanks again to Adrian, and yes, it is indeed Stuart Woodward time. Stuart, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
Well, I'm very well. Recovered after the weekend. Ready to talk about what happened.
Yes, a ding-dong battle, a seesawing affair at Nihon Daira. But ultimately, I suppose, Stuart, after three straight wins under Ange Postecoglou, we probably should have seen this loss for Yokohama coming.
Well, that's debatable, I think. it's definitely his kind of game plan worked out right until, when was it, the 80th minute. But after that, things went rapidly downhill.
Yes, it was a ding-dong battle with Yokohama twice taking the lead, pegged back on both occasions by Shimizu, and then after Marcos Junior's second yellow card, Stuart, basically it all went to bits for Yokohama with Douglas equalising for the second time, and then Kenta Nishizawa winning it at the death. So obviously a lot to cover before we kind of started at the end there, but for Yokohama we did see some of your beautiful football in your two goals, and I mean, you went on the road and you put on a bit of a show again. It's just unfortunate that it all unravelled at the end.
Yes, that's right. Like, I was really thinking we'd got it in the bag at when Nakagawa scored. And up until that point, you know, my first impression was that why are Shimizu bottom of the table? Because they were playing really well, I thought, for the first part of the match. And maybe they were looking for an early goal. And then I haven't seen them all season. So, you know, my only guess would be that they kind of faded off towards the end and lost games that way. But it doesn't seem to be that way. And Douglas, I'd actually forgotten where I'd seen Douglas before, because he was in the J League quite a few years ago and then came back after being in, I think, where was it? Was he in Saudi Arabia or one of the Arab countries? Mm. Yeah, but he played for Hiroshima, I believe. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, so I recognise his face, and he hasn't lost his form, though he's not obviously not the player that he used to be. But going back to the first half, like, there was one incident where Thiago Martins had a heading clash, and the referee seemed to be like holding up a finger to him, asking him if he could see straight after that, and seemed to be a little bit of concern. So he actually didn't come back on in the second half and was replaced by Hirose. And I think Hirose wasn't looking or thinking that he was going to play today, because he didn't really help very much in that last 10 minutes. But then another incident that happened in the first half was like within the first 25 minutes, five players were booked. So there was three Marinos players, two of the forwards, and two Espoirs players. So there were five players there in danger of getting a second yellow card, and the referee seemed a little bit happy to hand them out. And Marcos Jr. got his yellow card for putting his hand in the face of the player who was chasing him. And so if he hadn't have done that, he probably would have been able to make a shot towards goal. But instead, he kind of like pushed his hand backwards into the face of the defender and got a yellow card for that. And that was his first yellow card, which was later to haunt him. And so, as you said, Nakagawa scored one of his goals, making it 2-1. And 80 minutes, that looked like it. You know, we can usually hold on for another 10 minutes, even if it's a little bit of a nail biting experience. But then there was a mysterious incident that wasn't shown on the TV, and suddenly we saw Marcos charging off the field and. Letting his anger vent into a door on the way back into the changing rooms. And today I asked around friends, and we finally managed to find a video. I think it must have been from a TV last night, and it was a behind the goal video where the Shimizu defender was kicking the ball back up the field to restart the play, and it came right to Marcos Jr.'s feet. And he proceeded to punt it into the Shimizu second tier of the stadium. So the referee took one look at that and gave him a yellow card, and then gave him the red because that was his second. And that was like, I'm not sure what that would be classed as, whether it was the unsportsmanlike play or kind of like deliberate wasting time, you know. So it was a totally unnecessary thing to do. Then Marinos were down to 10 men. And quite often with this very kind of mentally intensive play that they're doing right now, they lose it, especially in the last 10 minutes. Like countless times we've had a goal in the last 10 minutes. Even the other day when we were like a 4-0 up, you know, like the loss with Kobe, Wellington got his goal at the very end. So it's very likely that last 10 minutes after a goal, after an incident, something's going to happen. So I made a timeline, you know, just to figure out what actually happened. So we're up to 84 minutes, and Shimizu have a corner. Then after that, Edgar Jr. Comes off, and he's riding on the stretcher, having a little bit of a smirk, and allows Tadanari Lee to come on. So we've got another change there in the lineup. And 87 minutes, 3 minutes to go. So play is restarted by Marinos' free kick. But almost immediately, Shimizu counter and shoot. And once again, the play goes back up the other end. Marinos, I think more Andrew Postecoglou's strategy in defence is just to keep the ball away from the goal as much. But once the ball is free, then we're in danger for those counters. But Shimizu got a goal kick, and Territon almost got it, but immediately the ball was punted upfield by Shimizu. Quick cross to Douglas and a goal, making it 2-2. So then the game was on once again, and we're now up to like 89th minute, and Douglas is going down and gets an offside, and even Douglas is having a little bit of a talk with the referee, gesturing that he didn't hear the whistle, and because he carried on playing and took a little bit of a shot at that point. And Douglas was in danger of getting a red card at that point too, if the referee had complained at that. But once again, Marinos, 90th minute, bad pass was intercepted, quick pass to Nishizawa, and he was unmarked on the left, and there you have 3-2. So all within that few minutes, everything went wrong. And I put it totally down to one, a lack of concentration, that to just playing the up to 86 minutes, formation changes, and restarting the match at that point. But also, there's no kind of control of the game apart from manically trying to score one more goal. So I remember watching a match with Marinos in the Higuchi days, and watching an excruciating last 5 minutes of the Marinos players on the penalty line, the goal line of Oita, and playing a rondo, keeping the ball in action for the last 5 minutes without letting Oita get the ball or putting them in danger of having a corner. So there was no real concept of actually slowing the game down, taking it easy. It was just gung-ho, try and score again. But that really didn't work in the to hold that lead. So how about Sam? What did you think about it?
Well, I only got to watch the first half because I was on the Tokyo Kobe game. But I agree with your assessment about the first half. I thought Shimizu looked quite good. I've always said this season that they're better than bottom of the league. They've got enough good players, especially going forward, but they're always going to concede chances at the back. I think the second goal especially is like a wide open chasm. Matsubara tries to play and play Nakagawa offside, gets it horribly wrong, and that's how they concede goals, a little bit of a lack of concentration. But I kind of caught the highlights at the end, and that the Marinos defence looks a little bit all over the place. I mean, Thiago Martins obviously going off at half-time, and then you've got no Dusan, who's just had knee surgery. So there's a lack of real defensive cover there. You didn't have Kurihara on the bench to come in at centre-back. So I wonder if that sort of lack of backup kind of really messed up the back line. They really didn't know exactly who should be where. I don't know exactly where Hirose was playing when he came on, if he fitted into centre-back or if he went to one of the full-back positions. And then I just wanted to kind of ask you if you think the inability really of Marinos to kind of play out a game professionally, especially when you're down to 10 men with a lead, is that something coming from Postecoglou and it's just like, I'm going to attack no matter what? Or is it kind of maybe a bit of an experience from the players? So I'm not sure what you think of that.
Well, yeah, I think it's probably a mix of both, because the squad is so different now compared to a year ago that almost everybody is playing under Postecoglou's orders and has been brought in by him. Like the only remaining members are Kida and Amano and Keita. So all of the others are kind of brought in to play his system, and it'd be kind of interesting to know what his view is, because it kind of seems that they try as much as possible to play in the opposition half and in the last third of the opposition half too, so to keep the ball up there quickly get it back. They're really prone to these like big long punts by Shimizu right up to somebody waiting around the back line of the Marinos defence. And if they got past that, then it's almost a free shot on goal. And it was quite interesting watching the highlights, because the highlights show like so many saves, and it looks like a very kind of balanced game in terms of. In terms of shots. And I think actually in the end, Shimizu had more shots than Marinos overall. But the possession, as we know, is very high. So the obviously the highlights don't give you really an impression of how much ball time they had. Like Marinos had that 73% possession to 27, but in the end. Shimizu had 9 shots on target to 3. So, yeah, I really don't know. Like, I think that all the team now are very much playing Postecoglou's system, and those who couldn't play his system or wouldn't play his system are out. So I would say it'd be very interesting to know what his ideas are, because it might just be, okay, well, we get 4 goals up and nobody's going to catch us at that point. So that's what they're going for, as we've seen in the past. But Yeah, I think this one is a little bit of a freak game. You know, I was very disappointed at the time, and I thought we definitely got it at the second goal, but you know, just couldn't hold it.
Yeah, well, for me, Stuart, you mentioned a lack of concentration. It's that. It's also just a complete lack of street smarts, in my opinion. I mean, you know, you're a man down, and okay. Ange Postecoglou's mantra is to control the ball and to try and go forward and score goals. But, I mean, there's 5 minutes to go in this game, and you cannot allow a ball over the top to Koya Kitagawa, and he's running in 30 yards of space to cross for Douglas to score. I mean, it's just completely unacceptable. And, I mean, it's going to be... different guests have said it over the last year and a bit. I mean, it's going to continue to be Yokohama's Achilles heel, in my opinion, because if you can't lock down a game like this, even when you go a man down, I mean, yeah, you just can't accept that kind of a defeat. Even to come away with a draw would have been disappointing after some of the football you played and the two excellent goals that you scored. But then, yeah, to actually throw it away and not take anything away from the game. I mean, you don't sound too downcast, but I mean, it's just that's just a horrible loss, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Like that was definitely my feeling. After watching it, it was kind of a long way home, and I was one of those I'm glad I didn't go there and get a soaking and then come home after that one. But you're right, like the goals that we concede and the matches we lose, there's often some kind of it's a shocking kind of a loss or a comedy goal, you know, given away. Like it's really like I say, like the flickering bulb. You know, when it's bright, it's bright, and then when it's dark, it's dark. But I think that one is, as you say, you know, the experience. If you had more experience, or hopefully they'll learn from it, that you just have to shut down at that point. You know, you can't do what they did there in the future. But I think a lot of games, you know, that's probably the way that we do lose it. And also, I know that the players really wanted to win that match, because Kawasaki drawing at the weekend, that would have put us at 30 points, 2 points ahead of them. So we would have been second in that, and that would have been a really great place to be, given, you know, with 2 points ahead of the contenders, and now 3 points ahead, would be 3 points ahead of the third and going down. So it was a really, like, probably could be a pivotal loss in the whole year when we look back.
Well, yes, we shall see. We've almost reached the halfway mark of the season. The Yokohama host Matsumoto on Saturday evening before travelling to FC Tokyo to round out the first half of the season. So that should be an interesting clash, and it's quite possible that it might be a clash of the top two, because Kashima have an ACL game in midweek, and then they travel to Urawa, while Kawasaki are away at Hiroshima. It's possible that by the time match day 17 rolls around, Stuart, that could be a clash of the top two, which would be very, very interesting indeed. There's obviously a long way to go in the season, and as you say, hopefully the Marinos players can learn from a result like this and make sure it doesn't happen again, because, as I say, yes, some of the football you played was absolutely terrific, and it deserved all 3 points on the night. But, yes, it wasn't to be, and hopefully, as we say, Ange can sit them down and give them a stern talking to and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, and all credit to Shimizu. Like, you know, if that had been the other way around, I would have been laughing all the way home. It would have been, you know, I'm sure that their fans really enjoyed that match in the end.
Most definitely. And Sam, I'll tell you what, Shimizu now unbeaten in four, and their fans have certainly got their money's worth in the last two home games at Nihon Daira. It's a 4-3 win over Sendai in the previous home game, and 3-2 here, both games won right at the death. So, Yeah, so there'll be some heart medication on sale in the shops around Nihon Daira, I reckon.
Yeah, but it's a really good sign that they're managing to pull through these games quite end-to-end. They know they're never going to keep many clean sheets, so they have to keep scoring, have to keep going to the end. Two late victories is great for them. It moves them outside the relegation zone, above Jubilo as well, which is a nice extra bonus. So I'm really happy for Shimizu, because I think it comes across that they're one of my kind of guilty pleasures, Shimizu. I really want them to do well. They're a very attacking team, dreadful defensively, but great to watch. I like that Yohei Nishibe has came back out of nowhere, 38-year-old goalkeeper. He's pulling off a few decent saves, still makes a few errors, but I'm glad that he's coming in, still doing well. But I'm just Shimizu, just defensively, they're always going to be down there, I think, because of the kind of haphazard defensive displays they have. El Sino and Matsubara both want to go forward from fullback, which leaves so many gaps. And Hwang Soko and Futami are really struggling. They're going to get overloaded. This was the case again against Marinos, when you've got the likes of Edgar Jr. and Marcos Jr. and Nakagawa really kind of flitting in and out, causing havoc. They couldn't deal with it for long periods. They couldn't even deal with the Vegalta Sendai attack a few weeks ago. So that's going to be a major issue that's going to have to be addressed in the summer. I don't think the current crop of players they've got, even when Hugo Tatsuta comes back from the Copa America, I don't think it's good enough defensively. But going forward, they've still got the likes of Kitagawa and Douglas. They're going to score goals, and I think they're going to try and just outscore their opponents for the rest of the season. It's going to be great to watch, and I hope it just about keeps them safe.
All right then. Okay, well, Stuart, yeah, Sam and I have 4 games left to wrap up in our review of a J1 Match Day 15. So we will let you go. thanks very much for popping on the podcast, and hope to speak to you again soon.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, my thanks again to Stuart. And yes, as I said, before we let Stuart go, 4 games left to review. And Oita hosting Nagoya was one of the big games on the Match Day 15 slate. Sam, it ultimately ended 1-1 down in Kyushu, and that meant that, I suppose, although at the start of play, both the teams probably would have taken a point, at the end of the day, they've both missed a chance to put some more pressure on the teams above them as they've slipped down the table in the past few weeks. As I said, after Tokyo's first loss, they went into that match day 13, second and third in the table, and now 2 games later, they find themselves in fifth and sixth. So, not really any danger of the season slipping away or anything, but both have obviously found wins very hard to come by, and with an identical record of 2 draws and 2 losses in their last 4. I guess at the end of the day, we're probably not too surprised that this ended in a draw, are we?
No, I think it's a kind of a pretty decent result for both teams. As you say, both come in and off a couple of losses. Nagoya's especially to the likes of Matsumoto and Sendai. They really needed to get some sort of point, get back to a bit of a positive result, and they kind of did that. I thought Oita played quite well. Again, they're back to their Barcelona star passing out from the back. I think the goal from Anayu, it starts from the goalkeeper, and it's a clip that's been widely circulated on Twitter, but they play so many passes from inside their own half. They keep it forever, allow all the press from Nagoya, and then just eventually ping a ball, cut through a couple of lines of Nagoya's team, and then are out on the counter-attack. It's a really well-worked goal. Anayu finishes it well off the rebound. He's just about onside, I think. So, really good piece of play from Oita. I think Nagoya then came into it more second half. And again, I think at the end, a draw was a fair result. Probably one that both teams will probably just accept. They've got the losing streak, and they've stopped that turning into anything. And hopefully then they can build on as the season goes on.
Yes, indeed. So it was Ado Onaiwu 8 minutes before half-time, giving host Trinita the lead. But yes, as Sam said, Nagoya improved after that. And Kazuya Miyahara slid in at the back post to tap in Ryuji Izumi's ball across the 6-yard box just 8 minutes after the restart. And so the points were shared down in Oita, and yes, so the winless run continues for both of them, but yes, a decent enough point for the pair of them, and yeah, gives them a chance to reinforce and get a much needed wins under their belts in the coming match day. Urawa and Tosu, I guess, Sam, it looked like it was heading for a draw until Tosu had a bit of bad luck right at the death with the Shinzo Kuroki scoring in the 93rd minute. I believe it was his 140th J1 goal. He moved above Kazuyoshi Miura in the J1 all-time scoring charts and is now a sixth in that chart on his own. So Shinzo Kuroki continuing his brilliant career with another landmark going past the King. And, you had to feel for Tosu here, Sam. You don't have to because, I mean, they're bottom of the table and they've played some pretty rubbish football at times this year. But, I mean, yeah, they looked so close to taking a point at Saitama Stadium. An Yong-woo had given them an 18th minute lead, but Tomiya Ugajin equalised before halftime with a terrific strike into the far corner across the keeper. But deep into stoppage time, Martinez embarked on a amazing run through midfield, and when a defender got a foot in, it looked like Tosu had escaped any serious danger, but the ball looped into the box and over a despairing Hiromu Mitsumaru, who was flinging himself into the air to try and head the ball away. The ball just looped over him and sat up deliciously for Kuroki to stroke a first-time finish into the far corner. So it's just one of those for Tosu. As we mentioned earlier, they slid back to the foot of the table. I mean, there's enough traffic around there that they won't be too downcast about that particular aspect of things. But, yeah, they will have been absolutely gutted when they got back to the sheds, wouldn't they?
Yeah, definitely. This was a really good performance, actually, from Tosu. It was really an end-to-end game. Both teams were going for it. Both teams had chances to win the game for themselves. And I think Tosu just... it was a lot more energy to them. Like, this season, they've really struggled, well-documented, in front of goal. But this game, they were attacking. Kanazaki was still snatching at everything. That's their problem. They snatch at all their chances, and there's no real composure, even when Torres is on. He's out of form and snatching at his chances as well. But they were really up for this game, and I thought it was a pretty even one. But Urawa, after the game against Kawasaki, are developing a nice habit of late goals, coming with a massive hint of fortune again with this looping one over Mitsumaru. So that'd be perfect for Urawa if they can keep winning games late on through strokes of luck. But they kind of earned their luck as well. They never stopped. Martinez's run kind of typified that. And I thought they looked a good team again. They still made changes for this game because they've got their big ACL game coming up on Wednesday. So a few youngsters were in. Kai Shibato in from the start. Andrew Nabok came in up front, gave a lot of energy. He's not really had a great amount of chances at Urawa through injury, and then kind of they were only playing one up front, and Shinzo Kuroki is that man, so he got a chance alongside of it, and he looked really good. And there was the typical link-up that you used to see from Urawa between the likes of Muto and Kuroki, especially for their first goal. The ball came in, then Muto, then Kuroki both dummied it superbly, left a lot of space for Ugajin, who's fired in a great curling effort for his goal. So there are definitely more signs of encouragement for both Urawa and Tosu, and it's great for Urawa that they're getting a little bit of confidence back, especially going into that Ulsan game, which is going to be very difficult in the ACL. Ulsan are one of the form teams in the continent, doing well in Korea, so that should be a really exciting game. But I think, yeah, good signs for both teams despite Tosu's loss.
Yeah, so Reds that take some positive vibes into that ACL round of 16 first leg at home against Ulsan on Wednesday. And yeah, Tosu were forced to lick their wounds on the long trip back to Kyushu. But yes, their run of three straight wins is now a distant memory after a second straight loss, as unfortunate as it was. But yeah, hopefully, I suppose, in the cold light of day when the coaches got them back in and sat them down. Hopefully he'll be able to take the positives out of the game, and the players will realise that they did acquit themselves well, and yes, were undone by some pretty horrible luck, yeah, it must be said, at the death. That leaves us with just two games to go, Sam, and they involve four of the teams that are down there in the bottom seven or eight spots in the table that we mentioned earlier. Basically extends from Kobe and Shonan down. They both have 17 points, and down to Tosu at the bottom on 13. Well, the teams that we have we are left to discuss are involved in that scrap as well. And Sendai claimed a huge, it might turn out to be a huge 1-0 away win at Matsumoto, thanks to Ryohei Michibuchi's header in the 36th minute. Sendai, as regular listeners will know, one of my tips to go down, Sam, but they've won three of their last five. They won their last two on the spin to move up to 13th. They're obviously a long way from considering themselves as safe and with any sort of breathing room, but they've turned things around. But another frustrating evening rather for the league's second lowest scorers at Matsumoto, shut out for the eighth time this season.
Yeah, Matsumoto, I think they've not really been in the relegation places all season, but I think they're the team I most worry about. There's not many goals in that team. Leandro Pereira looks decent enough, but it's the creativity behind him that's not really there. I think Sugimoto's a good player, but maybe not quite at the highest level. I think he's kind of dropped off from where he was as a youngster at Kashima, who looked really promising, but he's not really hitting those heights yet in J1. And then they lost Daisen Maeda, of course, to the Copa America, so Kei Nakami is an option. Ryo Nagai played in this game, but they didn't really create a lot. And there's a lot of kind of average players in that team, and they're very decent defensively. They're not conceding many goals, which will always keep them in games, but there's a lot of 1-0 defeats, and without scoring goals, I don't see them doing too well. They're in a tough spot. And like Sendai, who are quite an average team as well, there's not a huge amount of quality there, but they seem to just be able to find goals from somewhere. They put three past Nagoya last time out, obviously with a bit of help from the goalkeeper, and here they managed to squeak a goal. So there's just a little bit more quality in Sendai, but there's not a lot between the two teams, and I agree with you. I think Sendai are in trouble, even with this victory, because they can beat Nagoya and Matsumoto 1 week, but they've got a 2-0 loss to Jubilo to their name, so it's not great for them. I consider these two both two of the weaker teams in the league, and I wouldn't be surprised if both went down, to be honest.
Yeah, obviously still such a long way to go, but after this win, Sendai moved above Matsumoto on a goal difference. They are Sendai 13th in the table. They moved up three spots, while Matsumoto dropped two spots to 14th. Shimizu are the third team on 16 points, with an even inferior goal difference to Matsumoto, which is saying something. But yeah, Yamaga, they're scrappy, but they don't really have too much going for them going forward, especially, as Sam said, with the Daisen Maeda away at the Copa America. They really need some other players to step in while he is away. And, Sam said as well, they haven't been in the drop zone all season. But as things stand at the moment, if anybody below them wins and they lose, they're going to start slipping down even further. So, they really need to steady their ship in the coming weeks. But as we mentioned before we let Stuart go, their next game is a trip to the Nissan Stadium to face Yokohama, who are sure to be stinging after their late loss at Shimizu. So it is the J-League and anything's possible. And Matsumoto certainly do have a decent defensive display in them. So they'll definitely need to be at their best at the back when they travel to Yokohama this coming Saturday. All right, well, there's one game to go, Sam, and it was the other draw of the match day at the Yamaha Stadium. It finished Iwata 0, Gumba nil. And on the face of it, when you hear that the game between the teams at 14th and 15th in the table at kickoff, they actually both dropped two spots after this draw. After you hear a game like that finishes nil-nil, well, I almost didn't bother to check out the DAZN highlights package, but ultimately I'm glad I did, because there were a few chances at either end, and it's definitely some talking points. Somehow Genta Miura managed to be offside from a free kick taken about 6 or 7 inches inside the end line, but he basically arced his run behind the goal line into the goal and came out again before heading in the free kick, but the linesman had spotted that when the kick was taken, he was still basically behind the goal line and in the goal. So he was his goal was disallowed in the 26th minute. Miura ultimately played a part in Gumba getting anything from the game when he slid in the last 10 minutes to block a Hiroki Yamada shot. But yes, it was that man Christoph Kaminski who has come to Iwata's rescue so many times over the past few years, Sam, who saved them again at the death with some terrific late saves.
Yeah, Jubilo really are reliant on two players, Kaminski in goal and Kentaro Oye marshalling that back line, because when Oye was out, the defence was a bit of a shambles, Ominami in there just hoofing the ball into his own box and things like that. But those two players are the only reason that Jubilo are staying in games at the moment. Then only scored 11 goals, which I think is the third worst, which is, they're just, again, I've said this before, they've not built on last season where they were in that relegation playoff place and just kind of just a bit too good for Tokyo. But since then, they didn't bring in anyone of note during the window, and they've just kind of meandered their way through this season. I think that they still have chances. They've got decent players. I mean, Adeilton can score a goal. Hiroki Yamada I like, and Taguchi is a good player as well, but you're not going to get a regular goal scoring from those players, especially with Kawamata out injured as well. And they're just relying on defensive performances, which Matsumoto was sort of trying as well. I just think in the end that's going to catch up with them. As for Gamba, they kind of changed their system with these young players that worked well in that Osaka derby, and defensively, they've got a lot better. This start of the season, they were absolutely dreadful. But they've sorted that out, but it's kind of been at the expense of their attacking play. They've not really scored enough goals in the last few games. Nil-nil here. They maybe got, I can't remember the results really. It was one goal, I think, in the last game. One goal against Kashima, nil-nil with Sapporo. It's not really filling anyone with confidence. They tried to bring in Ryotaro Mishino because he's on the back of a couple of good goals, and that's fine. I think it adds a bit of a spark, but in general play, if you're going to take out one of Wang Weijo or Adam Nilsson, you're definitely losing something on the hope that this kid can produce a wonder goal. So I just think they should be playing their better players in Weijo and Adam Nilsson, and then maybe Meshino could be a good option off the bench if you need an extra spark. But because their forward play is just lacking something. Like, the young players they're decent, they're working really hard. That's where Endo and Kono were falling down, because they couldn't work as hard as the others, just for fitness reasons more than anything else. But they're lacking that creativity. And if you can't create enough chances to beat Jubilo, then you're going to struggle. And again, they're looking, as I mentioned earlier, they're looking at the likes of Idiguchi and Usami to come back. And if they can manage that, then great. They should be able to get that impetus to move out of this relegation zone. But as it stands, I still think they've got the quality to be quite clear of the relegation zone. But the moment, they're not putting teams away, and they're always going to struggle if you can't do that.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, I guess we're going to find out in the next month or so whether, the likes of Shimizu and Gumba, whether they are in false positions or whether they are just going to be stuck around in this muck for pretty much the whole season. As you said earlier, Sam, Espolsa's defensive problems don't show any sign of abating. And, Gumba putting so much faith in these young players, well, while results continue to be spotty at best, then you wonder how long Tsuneyasu Miyamoto is going to continue with that policy. And if he does, how long he's going to be backed? Because, the Gumba front office surely won't be able to stomach another relegation dogfight that could ultimately end in another trip down to the second tier. That won't be acceptable for the black and blue half of Osaka. They do obviously have a few months to sort things out, but Miyamoto will want to see an uptick in results, I'm sure. And their next opportunity to notch a win is against Shonan this coming Saturday. Belmare off the back of three straight losses, so you could argue that Gumba could not have a better opponent coming to the Panasonic Stadium. We shall see. That's our review of match day 15 done. We've mentioned the ACL coming up this midweek, with Kashima hosting Hiroshima on Tuesday night, and then Reds hosting Ulsan of South Korea on Wednesday. The return leagues, as we mentioned earlier, are the following week, and that means that our four ACL clubs' involvement in match day 16 will not take place until the following Wednesday, after the ACL is completed. So Hiroshima will host Kawasaki, and Reds will host Kashima on Wednesday the 31st of July, once the ACL round of 16 is done and dusted. So that means we only have seven games on the slate coming up this weekend. Six of them are on Saturday, and just one game on Sunday night. That is the Leaders FC Tokyo travelling to Sendai. So, plenty of action, I'm sure, even though the upcoming weekend is slightly abridged with the ACL teams, as I say, their games held over until a couple of weeks later. All right, Sam, well, as usual, it's been absolutely terrific to get your thoughts on all of the top flight games from the weekend. There's so much action, as we come to expect from J1, and indeed so many talking points. So, great to catch up with you, as I said, mate, and I hope to do so again soon.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thank you again for having me, and enjoy your week.
All right, thank you very much. So that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. My thanks again to Sam Robson, Adrian Serna, and Stuart Woodward, and, of course, to you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to review the seven games from J1 Matchday 16 that will take place this weekend, and we'll check in on Japan at the Copa America. Of course, Japan's first game is taking place on Tuesday morning Japan time against Chile. So, you will know the score of that game by the time this podcast has been released. So we hope that Japan acquit themselves well. And, we'll be talking about how Japan have gotten on so far in the tournament in next week's podcast. So we'll speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast.